expecting different results. Being willing and able to flex is one of the keys to persuasion. You can think of this flexibility in terms of physical things. If you were tasked to persuade or bend something, would you rather it be a branch from a willow tree or a steel rod? Most people would say the willow branch because it is flexible, easier to bend, and makes the task accomplishable. Trying to persuade others while being unyielding and inflexible doesn't work, and neither does persuasion if you are not flexible. Many times, an audit will not go as planned. A good social engineer will be able to roll with the punches and adjust their goals and methods as needed. This does not go against the idea of planning ahead. Instead, it bespeaks the point of not being so rigid that when things do not go as planned, you can move and adapt so the goal is not lost. The way a person would view an insane person is the way a target would view the inflexible social engineer. A social engineer would look unreasonable and you would most likely never reach endgame. Get in touch with yourself. By getting in touch with yourself, I am not suggesting some Zen meditation avenue. Just that you understand your emotions. Emotions control practically everything you do, as well as everything your target does. Knowing your emotions and being in touch with yourself can help you lay the groundwork for being an effective social engineer. Going back to the earlier example of you and your smoking friend, approaching your friend, if you have a deep-seated hatred for those who smoke, affects your approach. It can make you act, express, say, or do something that will close the door to persuasion. You may never compromise on certain things, and being aware of those things and your emotions about them can help you to develop a clear path toward influencing a target. These five fundamentals are key to understanding influence and persuasion. Being able to create an environment where a target wants to do what you are requesting is the goal of persuasion, and these five fundamentals will help you create that environment. The next section examines how social engineers use these fundamentals. Influence tactics. As mentioned, social engineers must practice the skill of persuasion until it becomes part of their everyday habits. This doesn't mean that they must influence everyone in everything they do, but being able to turn this skill on and off at will is a powerful trait of a good social engineer. Influence and persuasion have many aspects you can use and many that fit easily into an audit. Other aspects might not fit so easily, but hold a very powerful position in the world of influence. The following sections cover 8 different techniques of influence that are used often by media, politicians, government, con men, scammers, and of course, social engineers. Each section provides an analysis of each technique to see how it is used in other areas of influence, besides social engineering, as well as takes a closer look at how it can apply to a social engineer. Reciprocation. Reciprocity is the inherent expectation that when others treat you well, you respond in kind. A simple example is when you are walking into a building, if someone holds a door open for you, he expects you to say thank you, and then make sure that the next door stays open for him as he comes in. The rule of reciprocity is important because often the returned favor is done unconsciously. Knowing this means that you now have a step up on how you can use it as a social engineer. Before getting into that, though, here are a few examples where reciprocity is often used. Pharmaceutical companies will spend $10,000 to $15,000 per doctor, yes, per doctor, on gifts that might include dinners, books, computers, hats, clothing, or other items that have the drug company's logo on it. When the time comes to choose a drug to support and buy, to whom do you think the doctors are more likely to go? Politicians are influenced in much the same way. It is no secret that many times politicians or lobbyists are more favorable to people who helped their political campaign than those who did not. Reciprocity is often used in business, especially when it comes to matters of contracts. Maybe the sales guy will pay for a meal, then later on ask for a concession in the contract. The client is compelled to give this concession. A fellow employee filled in for you one week when you needed a day off. Now she asks you to return the favor, but you have plans. In this situation, people will reschedule and honor the request. All of these are examples of reciprocity. Sociologist Alvin Guldner wrote a paper called The Norm of Reciprocity, in which he states, "Specifically, I suggest that a norm of reciprocity in its universal form makes two interrelated minimal demands. One, people should help those who have helped them. And two, people should not injure those who have helped them. The norm of reciprocity may be conceived of as a dimension to be found in all value systems, and in particular, as one among a number of principal components, universally present in moral codes." Basically, his research led him to see that reciprocity works despite cultural backgrounds. Reciprocity, used under the right circumstances, is all but impossible to resist. The following sections expand on some key points of the preceding idea. Give something away. The thing you give away can't be some simple piece of junk. The thing given must have value to the recipient. Giving away a beautiful hardcover novel written in a language the recipient does not read or collect is useless. The item can be a service, a physical item, some valuable information, assistance, or anything else that the receiver will deem as a value. Even something as simple as holding the door or picking up something dropped. Some sales organizations promote this method, but then fall short of offering something that has no value. Imagine you are at a trade show, and at each table is a giveaway. If you walk up to a table and notice a pile of cheap-looking pins, you might just walk by. The next table has an interesting puzzle-like game. You are intrigued, so you pick it up. After you spend a few minutes playing with it, the salesperson approaches and says, "You want a hint?" After showing you a small hint, he asks whether you have a minute so he can show you a service you might really love. How can you say no? You get an intriguing game, a free hint, and now all he wants is a minute of your time? It's a perfect setup. Create indebted feelings. The more value the gift has to the recipient, and the more unexpected it is, the greater the sense of indebtedness. Not allowing the gift to be used in an obvious manipulation tactic is important. Don't say or act like, "I gave you this gift, now you owe me." Even thinking it can take away any feelings of indebtedness. The gift should be totally free and of great value to the recipient. The Humane Society of the United States, for instance, gives away personalized mailing labels as a free gift. No strings are attached, and many people use them for holiday cards or personal letters. They are attractive and good quality. You sign up for them, and many months later you will get a call asking for a donation to support your local Humane Society. The recipient's sense of obligation is usually too great not to contribute even a little. By way of another example, Fortune magazine offers college professors free issues of its magazine to try out in their classes with no strings attached at all. Many examples of reciprocity like these exist. On the flip side, many companies fail at reciprocity by thinking things like the following are good gifts. Sharp-looking and colorful corporate brochures. Useless and junky toys. Sales literature about your products or company. These things do not build indebtedness. The recipient must deem the gift valuable. Another source of gifts that can build true indebtedness is information. Giving away a valuable, beneficial, or useful piece of information can literally be of more interest than a physical gift to some. Ask for what you want. On one occasion, I was entering a building. I saw a man who looked very much to be the boss get out of his car parked in the spot marked "For CFO Only." And he was on his cell phone. He was not a happy guy. I overheard him telling someone that he was upset because he had to go inside and let some people go. I assumed from his tone that he was on with his wife or girlfriend and he didn't like the job he was about to do. I walked past him and went to the front desk, and as I walked up, I saw that the girl behind the desk was playing Minesweeper. As I approached the counter, she gave me the standard, "How can I help you?" She had a look on her face that said she was bored and not in the mood. I said, "Look, I'm here for a meeting, but your boss is about to walk in and he is in a bad mood." I then trailed off and just stood there with a folder in my hand. A few seconds later, the boss stormed in the front door and said loudly, "Thank you so much for your assistance." She looked over and said to me, "Excuse me, sir," then said to her boss, "Good morning, Mr. Smith. I have your messages," and then handed him a small pile of paper as he walked by. When he disappeared to his office, she thanked me profusely. I just saved her, and she knew it. The information I gave her was invaluable, and my next words would be imperative. "I need your help. I wanted to see the HR manager just for a brief meeting. Can you get me into her office real quick?" She walked me back to the manager's office and introduced me as her friend that stopped in. Within minutes, my plan was launched, and all thanks to reciprocity. As a social engineer, look for little opportunities to give out information that will make you valuable to the recipient, and more importantly, make the recipient indebted to you. Be aware of your surroundings and what little things you can do to make your targets indebted to you. Remember, it doesn't have to be something amazing, just something that they value. A good point to keep in mind is to not stalk the target. Standing and staring at him or her, waiting for an opportunity to do or say something can be off-putting. These principles should be natural. Naturalness means you start doing these principles in everyday life. Hold doors for people, be very polite, and look for opportunities to do good things for others. These actions will become second nature, and you will have fewer struggles doing them in an audit. Reciprocity is a powerful influence tactic. And the next two principles discussed are closely tied into it. Obligation. Obligation has to do with actions one feels he needs to take due to some sort of social, legal, or moral requirement, duty, contract, or promise. In the context of social engineering, obligation is closely related to reciprocation, but is not limited to it. Obligation can be as simple as holding an outer door for someone, which will usually make him hold the inner door for you. It can be escalated to someone giving you private info because you create in them a sense of obligation to you. Obligation is a common attack vector used when targeting customer service people. You can use obligation in small doses by utilizing smart complimenting. For example, compliment a person, then follow it up with a request. This technique is very easy to do wrong if you are new or inexperienced and can come across so fake that it alerts the target's inner sense and has the wrong effect. But if done properly, it can lead to obtaining even little pieces of valuable information. An example of complimenting in the wrong way would be something like, "Wow, you have beautiful eyes. Can I get into your server room?" Sounds stupid, huh? Be sure to say your method out loud to see how it sounds. If it sounds like a cheap pickup line, then it has to go. A small conversation like this, on the other hand, can be a very proper way to compliment. As you approach the receptionist's desk, you see some pictures of a couple of little children at Disney World, and after you introduce yourself, you say, "Are those your kids? They sure are cute." Regardless if they are the receptionist's kids or her nephews, she will most likely enjoy your compliment. Then you follow up with, "I have a couple of my own. They keep us young, huh?" "Yes, my two kids. And I'm not sure about young," she chuckles, "but they do tire me out." "I haven't taken mine to Disney yet," I say. "Did you find they enjoyed it at that age?" "Oh yeah, they loved every second of it," says the receptionist. "As long as my daughter is with her daddy, she's having fun." "Ah, yeah, I have my little princess too," I reply. Well, I could stand here and talk about my kids all day, but I'm wondering if you can help me out. I called in and spoke to someone last week about a new HR software package, and I said I would drop off this information packet, but I lost the paper I wrote her name on. I'm terribly embarrassed. Oh, that's probably Mrs. Smith, offers the receptionist. She handles all of that. You are a lifesaver. I owe you one. Thank you. These types of compliments go a long way to opening the target up to be more agreeable to influence. The golden rule, treat others as you wish to be treated, is a key principle in creating obligation. Treating people kindly and giving them something they may need, even if it is as small as a compliment, can create a sense of obligation to you. Psychologist Steve Bressert makes this point in his article, Persuasion and How to Influence Others, in which he states, according to the American Disabled Veterans Organization, mailing out a simple appeal for donations produces an 18% success rate. Enclosing a small gift, such as personalized address labels, nearly doubles the success rate to 35%. Since you sent me some useful address labels, I'll send you a small donation in return. If you want to prove to yourself the power of this principle, try this simple exercise. Even something as small as a question can create obligation. The next time someone asks you a question, say nothing. Just stay silent, or ignore it, and move on in the conversation. Notice how awkward that is. Something as simple as a question creates a sense of obligation to answer. Simply asking the target a question can lead to amazing results. If your first action creates a feeling that there is an expected follow-up, then fulfilling that expectation can lead to strong feelings of obligation. When the person with whom you are interacting expects a result, fulfilling it can create a strong sense of commitment in him or her to do the same for you. This method can be used, for example, by sending the CFO of a company a piece of technology, maybe an iPod loaded with malicious software. When he gets the gift, he is obligated to plug it in. One successful attack vector I saw in play was where the social engineer sent a small, relevant gift to the CFO, or CEO, with a card that said, "Please accept a small gift from our company. All we ask is that you browse our products at www.products.com and download our PDF catalog here at www.products.com/catalog.pdf. I will call you next week." This method was successful every time. Concession. A concession, or the act of conceding, is defined as an acknowledgement or admission, or the act of yielding. Concessions are used often within the social engineering context as a play on the reciprocation instinct of humans. Humans seem to have a built-in function that makes them want to do unto others as they do unto you. A social engineer can use the something-for-something idea, or the I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine principle. There are basic principles to concessions and how to use them properly. Label your concessions. Make it known when and what you are conceding, which makes it difficult for your mark to ignore the urge to reciprocate. This will take balance, because you don't want to blow a trumpet, so to speak, while you announce a concession, but a simple statement like, "Okay, I'll give you this one," or "I'll meet you halfway," show you are willing to concede. Demand and define reciprocity. You can start by planting the seeds of reciprocation, and this increases your chances of getting something in return. An easy way to start planting these seeds is through nonverbal communication, showing that you are flexible, and also by being a good listener. These little things can make a big difference when building feelings of reciprocation in your target. Make contingent concessions. You can use risk-free concessions when trust is low, or when you need to signal that you are ready to make other concessions. What I mean by this is a concession that does not come with a "now you can do something for me" attitude. By giving in to something the target wants or needs with no counter-demand, you can build a very strong bond with the target. make concessions in installments. The idea of reciprocity is deeply ingrained in our minds. Most people feel that if someone does them a favor, then they are socially contracted to eventually return that favor. Similarly, if someone makes a concession, say in a negotiation or bargaining agreement, then one instinctively feels obligated to budge a little bit, too. Since this is a fact, you do not have to feel that all your concessions must be at one time. You can make installments with your concessions, where you give a little here and a little there over time to keep your target reciprocating. Concessions are used daily by salespeople, negotiators, and social engineers. A successful social engineer can use and abuse this instinctual tendency by not only resisting the manipulations being placed on them by others, but also by trying to take over the situation completely. Concession and reciprocation skills play well with many of the other social engineering techniques discussed within the pages of this book. An example of how many people fall for concessions can be illustrated with telemarketers who call for donations. They use a strategy for gaining concessions after someone is first given the opportunity to turn down a large request. The same requester counteroffers with a smaller request that you are more likely to accept than a large request. Large request: can you donate $200 to our charity? Response: no, I cannot. Smaller request: oh, I'm sorry, sir, and I understand. Can you donate only $20? People who are not aware of this technique might feel like the burden is taken off of them rather than the initial asking price of $200. Another great example appeared in an article written by David Hill. The power of this norm can be felt in most bargaining situations. Assume a buyer and a seller are haggling over the price of a car. The seller starts out with a bid of $24,000. The buyer finds this offer unacceptable and makes a counter bid at $15,000. Now the seller lowers his bid to $20,000, i.e., he makes a concession. In this case, the buyer will most often feel inclined to increase his bid, maybe to $17,000. The reason why the buyer will feel this inclination is because of the presence of the norm of reciprocity. This norm now demands that the buyer responds to the seller's concession with another concession. As with most of the principles discussed so far, the concession must be valuable to the receiver. You can't concede something that is valuable only to you, or you lose the power you gain with a good concession. As a social engineer, not giving a concession that will cause you to lose face, rapport, or your position is also imperative. A delicate balance must exist between the concession and your standing with the target, and finding it is half the work. Find it, though, and concessions can be a very serious tool in your hands. Scarcity. People often find objects and opportunities more attractive if they are rare, scarce, or hard to obtain. This is why you will see newspapers and radio ads filled with last day, limited time, only 3-day sale, and going out of business forever, messages that entice people to come from all over and get a share of the soon-to-be-never-seen-again product. The use of scarcity in the sales context is best known as the catchphrase. Act now. Supplies are limited. Other techniques are the common, the first X callers get a free widget, or having an intentional short supply of a product. In recent times, this practice was most popularly alleged with the Nintendo Wii. Jason Dobson, a writer for Gamasutra, said, "But I think Nintendo intentionally dried up supply because they made their numbers for the year. The new year starts April 1st, and I think we're going to see supply flowing." Where I live, a car dealership ran an ad on a Thursday stating it had to get rid of X number of cars due to new stock arriving. The prices were so low and some of the cars, wait for it, were no longer being produced. And that weekend was the last weekend ever that you could come in for a piece of auto selling history. The sales went through the roof that weekend. So the sale was over, right? Nope. That ad ran every Thursday for more than 3 months. I often wondered how people just didn't catch on to it, but the dealership sold a lot of cars using this method. Social events can often appear to be more exclusive if scarcity is introduced. The perceived social benefit of attending these events often goes up in these circumstances. In advertising, this point is driven home with ads for music events that point out how the last concert was quickly sold out. Many popular restaurants have been known to close off sections of the restaurant to appear busier than they really are. The perception that they are extremely popular can often trigger a heightened desire to eat at that establishment. The basics of economics are made up of the allocation of resources that have alternative uses. This allocation is driven by the scarcity of the objects that are being allocated. The rarer the resource, the higher the perceived value the object retains. This rarity is why gold is worth more than salt, which is worth more than clay. Also, within daily interactions, scarcity is often used. Scarcity can be introduced into social situations in an attempt to make something one has go up in value. For instance, one might act like he is very busy on a regular basis and free time is hard to come by. This action may excuse him from not spending time with someone he may have an obligation to spend time with, and at the same time, make time that is spent seem that much more valuable. You can manipulate attention through the use of scarcity as well. Think of how many people complain about salesmen bothering them in a store when there is no scarcity of salespeople's attention, yet that they are just as upset when they are ignored by a salesperson when their attention is scarce. On the whole, people are driven to desire that which is hard to obtain, because it is viewed as having more value. This holds true for attention as well. Scarcity is often used in social engineering contexts to create a feeling of urgency in a decision-making context. This urgency can often lead to manipulation of the decision-making process, allowing the social engineer to control the information provided to the victim. This is done commonly by using a mixture of authority and scarcity principles. For example, saying something like, "The CFO, Mr. Smith, called me before he left for the long weekend and told me to come down and fix his email problem. He said he was sick and tired of the crashes and wanted it fixed before Monday." This creates urgency alongside scarcity in that the CFO is not available to speak to and time is the scarce item. Using scarcity mixed with other principles can also make the attack even deadlier. Either way, scarcity creates a desire, and that desire can lead someone to making a decision he might regret later. This was proven to me recently when a truck pulled into my driveway with a freezer in the back. The decently dressed young man approached my wife and explained that he is a meat salesman. He delivers meat to customers and was just about to head back to the office and saw her working in the yard. He began talking about meat prices and how expensive things are in the store. My wife is a very price-conscious shopper, so this built rapport. Plus, he had a very pleasant southern accent and called her ma'am and was very respectful. After a few minutes of talking, she blurts out the question that usually stops salesmen dead: "How much do you want?" Without missing too much of a beat, he says, "Listen, I've been selling these all day for $400 a box, but this is my last box. I would love to just go back to the office with an empty freezer and give you some high-quality meat in the meantime." "Oh no, the last box?" He told her before he only comes through once every 2 months. The desire has been raised, but my wife is no dummy. She knew she was being manipulated. She excused herself and came to get me. He went through his spiel and laid on the scarcity thick. Of course, this type of an account can be a lesson on how to not fall for this tactic. The problem is that emotions get involved. He sees that I have a grill outside that looks used, so he knows I love to cook outside, and he plays on that. He then talks about the quality of the meat and quickly makes comparisons to restaurant quality and what is used in his boxes. Many people could easily fall for the emotional aspect of this sales pitch. What if it is his last one? He is right. This is much cheaper than eating out. He comes to me. I don't even have to drive to the store. Instead, I whipped out a calculator and asked him for the amount for the two last boxes, divided by the weight, and then asked my wife how much she normally pays per pound for the Delmonico or ribeye in the store. When her price came in lower by $3 per pound, I simply shut up. Now his emotions get involved. He scrambles to save face. He lowers his price by $150 off the bat. I again do the math, and he is still 50 cents more per pound. He tries to talk about quality, convenience, all those aspects that make it worth the 50 cents more. I shift my posture and position to be away from him and to show disinterest. Without saying anything, he trails off at the end of a weak spiel and offers me another $50 off. I tell him, sorry, I just don't think it's worth it. He then does the classic mistake that shows how his claims of scarcity were false. He caves in more. How much do you want to pay for these boxes? I could probably do 100. If you can give me 125, we can call it a deal. Now mind you, a little bit ago, he was at $400 per box. And they were the last two in this area for 2 to 3 months. This should have been a bidding war for that value, but instead, I sent him packing with his two boxes of meat and no cash. The lesson in this story for social engineers is that for scarcity to work, it either has to be real or you have to stick to your guns to give the appearance of reality. People will perceive the value higher when something is really in need. A malicious example of this is how the petrol companies raised the prices of fuel after Hurricane Katrina. The claim was that fuel was in shortage due to the destruction, which caused terrible price increases. Of course, if this were true, then the fuel would be worth a lot more than it is. Instead, it was an example of the claim of scarcity used to make money. Yet at the same time, when BP's error caused millions of gallons of oil to be lost in the Gulf of Mexico, ruining the ecosystem, instead of fuel prices skyrocketing due to lack of supply, they dropped. How? Well, I won't get into that here, but it proves the point that for scarcity to work, it has to be believable. And this is where the oil companies fail, and where social engineers can fail too. From a social engineer standpoint, the more limited or difficult it is to obtain an opportunity, the more value it will have to people. If information is deemed as private, restricted, and hard to come by, and you are willing to share it with someone, you have just gained a lot of value in their eyes. A social engineer can leverage scarcity with information by using a statement like, "I'm not supposed to be saying this, but," or, "I'm not sure you heard this news, but I overheard." Statements like these, spoken in hushed tones, imply that this information is scarce. Authority. People are more willing to follow the directions or recommendations of someone they view as an authority. Finding a person who has enough assertiveness to question authority directly, especially when that authority holds direct power over him or is face to face with him, is uncommon. Children, for example, are taught to obey adults such as teachers, counselors, priests, and nannies because they have authority over them. Often, questioning authority is deemed as disrespectful, and abject obedience is what is rewarded. These principles carry over into adult life because we are taught to respect authority figures and not question rules or orders given to us by those we deem authorities. Unfortunately, it is this principle that leads many children into the hands of abusers and molesters. Of course, not this principle solely, but those who prey on children realize how children are taught about authority and often seek out those who appear to be more compliant. Similarly, malicious social engineers use this principle to manipulate their targets to take some action or inaction that can lead to a breach. Understanding how authority is used from a social engineering aspect is important. German sociologist and political economist Max Weber defined authority into categories that I have adapted to fit more closely into the realm of social engineering. Legal authority. Legal authority is based upon government and law. This generally applies to law enforcement officers or others who enforce the laws of the land, area, or facility you are presently in. As a social engineer, pretexts that involve law enforcement or other government officials are usually illegal. However, security guards, bank security, or other types of enforcement authority figures can be well represented and are often used by social engineers. In one episode of the BBC television program, The Real Hustle, Paul Wilson and his cohorts dressed up like the guards who collect the money. When someone shows up in the uniforms that look similar to the real ones and acts as a normal person in the authoritative position would act, targets have little reason to doubt the imposter is who he says he is. Acting as an authority figure is a major ploy used by social engineers to gain access to a company. Another ploy that can be effective is posing as a lawyer who is seeking certain information. Playing a role that is generally feared or respected by the masses can be one way a legal authority ploy is used. Organizational authority. Organizational authority is quite simply any authority defined by means of an organization. Typically, this refers to a supervisory hierarchy. Someone within a position of power in an organization has more power to access more information than someone at the bottom of the hierarchy. In a social engineering audit, a consultant may impersonate the CIO or someone else with clearly defined organizational authority. The consultant may then be able to obtain passwords or other information from the help desk or any other employee who may perceive that the impersonated person has authority over him or her. In a paper entitled The Social Engineering of the Internet Fraud, Jonathan J. Rush of the U.S. Department of Justice writes, "People are highly likely in the right situation to be highly responsive to assertions of authority, even when the person who purports to be in a position of authority is not physically present." This ploy is used in other ways. Not by acting as if you are the CFO, but instead, sent or authorized by the CFO. The authority the name and the title wields may be enough to grant that power to the attacker in the eyes of the target. Rush cites an experiment performed by Robert B. Cialdini and recorded in his book Influence in 1993, which showed 95% of nurses within 22 stations from three different hospitals were willing to administer patients a dangerous dose of medication based upon a phone call from a researcher purporting to be a physician the nurses had never met. This experiment clearly shows that based upon orders and the perceived notion of authority, people might take certain actions despite their better judgment. This type of authority can and is often used to exploit companies into giving away valuable data. Social authority. Social authority refers to the natural-born leaders of any social group. A social group could consist of co-workers, college friends, or any other gathering of people. In Influence, Cialdini writes, "When reacting to authority in an automatic fashion, there is a tendency to often do so in response to the mere symbols of authority rather than to its substance. For a social authority to occur, an extraordinary amount of time or structure may not be needed to define an authoritative figure. In any setting, a quick flash of social proof where people are influenced by a group of people taking the same action may help provide a person social authority. Social authority can be used to an advantage in social engineering by asking or pressuring the target for information. If the target refuses and is therefore not liked by the leader of the group, the target may fall out of favor with the entire group. Complying with the leader's social authority is perceived to be advantageous. Social authority is successfully used when neither directly stated or implied that a previous person or group reacted the way that the attacker is asking. Yesterday, the CFO sent me down to take care of this problem, and Joe let me through and checked all my credentials. Did he put them on file? A simple statement like that utilizes a few forms of authority. If you comply with authorities mindlessly, you may respond to symbols of authority rather than reality. 3. Authority symbols are particularly effective in Western countries. You may reward people with any one of these, and no other evidence of authority for their compliance. Titles, clothes, automobiles. In an interview I conducted with Dr. Ellen Langer, Harvard psychologist and researcher of persuasion and influence, she talked extensively about mindlessness. She stated that people often do much of their work in a state where there is not much thought. In other words, they are in autopilot. In those positions, the abuse of the authority role is very dangerous. Perceived authority can make someone on autopilot react without limits. Using the right clothes, body language, and even having a fake business card printed has worked for many social engineers in presenting an authority stance and keeping their targets in autopilot. Other forms of authority may come into play for a social engineer than the ones outlined here, but these are the most commonly used. Authority is a powerful force when it comes to influencing others. And with a little bit of reasoning and information gathering, a social engineer can effectively use an authority pretext to his or her advantage. Commitment and consistency. People value consistency in others, and they also want to appear consistent in their own behavior. Generally, people probably want their words, attitudes, and deeds to be consistent and congruent. Consistency reduces the need to reprocess information and offers shortcuts through complex decisions. Gut feelings, those moments where you sense that an action is good or bad or right or wrong based on past experience, are often indicators that a decision being made might be against previously committed feelings and beliefs. These signals often indicate that you feel pushed to agree to something that you don't want. Gut feelings can also occur when it comes to making commitments. Gut feelings may indicate that you are uncertain of whether your commitment was a mistake. You can ask yourself, knowing what I now know, if I could do that again, would I make the same commitment? Before looking at how a social engineer can use consistency to gain someone's commitment, here are 3 examples that might help hit this point home. Marketing. Companies often spend extraordinary amounts of money to gain market share. There is no real return, but they fight to remain in that share that they believe to be profitable. Coca-Cola and Pepsi are great examples of using marketing throughout the decades in the fight to remain visible. Yet often a commercial will not sway a person to switch from Pepsi to Coke, because these two companies have been committed to the war against each other, it seems that when one of them comes out with a new product or marketing idea, the other is not too far behind. Auctions. The increased popularity of online auction houses such as eBay has this principle more visible. People feel a level of commitment to something they place a bid on, and if someone outbids them, it is as if they are compelled to bid again. At times, they will even increase the bid way past their comfort zone because they feel committed to it. One classic example of this is when Robert Campo bought Bloomingdale's. He paid $600 million more than it was worth. Max Bazerman, author of Negotiating Rationally, quoted a journalist from the Wall Street Journal as saying, "We are not dealing with price anymore, but with egos." Carnivals, game houses, and so on. Anytime gambling or game houses are involved, a greater risk exists of commitment and consistency being used to persuade people. One columnist, Ryan Healy, an online marketing consultant, wrote a story about when he took his daughter to a circus. He spent $44 on the tickets, $5 to park his car, then 40 minutes of drive time to get there. He was committed to being at the circus. His daughter wanted cotton candy, so he committed to a yes by giving her $5. How could cotton candy cost more than that? When the vendor came by and said the bag was $12, how could he back out on his commitment now? He couldn't, and therefore ended up spending $12 on a single cotton candy. Consistency in this pretense is defined as what is expected based on previous experience or expectations. That experience or expectation can motivate a target to take an action that can cause a breach. For example, when the tech support guy comes, it is expected he will go to the server room. That request is consistent with the previous experience and expectation. When access to the server room is requested, it is more likely to be fulfilled because it is consistent with what is expected. Commitment and consistency can be strong influence factors upon most people to take actions, give information, or divulge secrets. A social engineer can make commitment and consistency some of the most powerful tools in his or her arsenal. If a social engineer can get a target to commit to something small, usually escalating the commitment is not too hard. In his book, Influence, Robert Cialdini writes, "The key to using the principles of commitment and consistency to manipulate people is held within the initial commitment. That is, after making a commitment, taking a stand or position, people are more willing to agree to requests that are consistent with their prior commitment. Many compliance professionals will try to induce others to take an initial position that is consistent with a behavior they will later request." The social engineer hoping to employ the technique of commitment and consistency usually tries to get the target to divulge a small piece of information toward the overall intended goal. By getting the subject to remain consistent with things he or she has already said, the attacker may get the subject to reveal even more information. On the other hand, the attacker must remain consistent with what he is asking. The attacker should start off small and escalate the information gathering. To use an unrealistic example, an attacker should never start off asking for the nuclear launch codes. This request will be denied, and the attacker will be left few options but to backpedal the request. However, starting off small and escalating the value of the information requested with each new piece of gathered information will seem like a more natural progression and will not appear so obvious to the victim. Going slowly and progressively can be hard, as social engineers are often impatient and want to get the password right now. Playing it cool and remaining patient can make this avenue rewarding. Clearly defining, maybe even writing out, a path that you can use on each audit can help you go into the audit with clearly defined goals and a path to accomplish them. Getting a target to verbally commit to a certain action can force the target into a certain path of action. Cialdini states, "The commitment and consistency rule states that once we make a decision, we will experience pressure from others and ourselves to behave consistently with that decision. You can be pressured into making either good or bad decisions depending on your past actions. Maybe you have felt this if you ever verbally told your wife or spouse that you wanted to lose weight. That verbal commitment leads to a lot of pressure to hold up your end of the bargain. Sometimes, ending up disagreeing with yourself can be hard and almost impossible. Everyone has at one point or another muttered the phrase, 'I'm sorry, I changed my mind,' at least once in our lives. When we do, we hang our head in shame. Our voice tones drop and we sound sad. Why? We have just broken a commitment we made and we feel guilty for doing it. Even small, seemingly insignificant commitments can lead to exploitation. For example, a phone conversation often used by solicitors goes something like this. 'Hello, how are you today?' You answer, 'I'm doing great.' Now, prepare for the exploit. That is good to hear, because some people who are not doing so great can use your help. You can't go back now on what you said, because you are still doing great and committed to it. This is not to say you need to be so paranoid that you cannot even answer simple questions without the fear of exploitation, but being aware that one commitment does not mean you must commit to everything that follows is vital. I once worked with a guy who could literally get anyone to do the worst jobs and make them think it was their idea. Ensuring their commitment was one method he used. If you committed to a path of agreeing with him on certain things, which was almost impossible not to do because he got you to say yes up front, then you had to continue to say yes. Those yeses led down a path, and that path was right to where he wanted, agreeing to do the job he needed to get done. Being aware that it is okay to say no can save you from committing to something that could be disastrous. Yet sometimes we convince ourselves that saying no is some form of cardinal sin that needs many prayers to be forgiven. In the earlier example of the frozen meat salesman, my wife is a very self-aware person. Knowing she might be manipulated by a seemingly good deal, she came inside to get me because I am a jerk. One of the best examples I have heard that really shows the power of commitment is a social experiment done by Dr. Thomas Moriarty in 1972. He sent his assistant to the beach as a victim with a portable radio. The victim sat in his chair listening to the radio for about 10 minutes. Then he got up to go purchase a drink. While he was gone, another assistant, the criminal, who no one knew was working with him, came by to steal the radio. 4 out of 20 people, that's only 20%, stopped the thief from taking the radio. The researchers then upped the ante in the next round. Before the victim would leave to buy the drink, he would ask one of the neighboring sunbathers to watch his radio for him. What do you think the change was? Now a staggering 19 out of 20 stopped the thief, some even resorting to violence. Why the staggering difference? Commitment and consistency. The researcher obtained commitment from the neighboring sunbathers, and that caused them to have to act consistently with that commitment. In my opinion, these are amazing statistics that show the power of this influence method. A social engineer can effectively use this method of influence to get a target to commit to even a small act or a small yes, and use that commitment to escalate it into a larger set of actions. Liking. People like people who like them. As tongue-twisting as that phrase is, it is a very true statement. Understanding the full depth of that statement gets you much closer to mastering persuasion. When I say understanding the depth, I really mean that because that sentence has much more to it than meets the eye. This statement isn't saying that people who like you will respond well. Salespeople are often taught that people buy from people they like. That is true, but not the point. It also isn't saying that people must like you. It is saying that you must like people, and that they will like you in return. This task is not as easy as it sounds, because liking someone cannot be faked. As discussed in Chapter 5, smiles and happiness are very hard to fake. You must go into the circumstance genuinely caring for the person who you are trying to influence. Caring for people and their feelings is not a standard practice of the malicious social engineer. Therefore, they often rely on charm. Charm can work on a short-term basis, but in the long term, liking people is a practiced and learned skill. Liking is used in marketing extensively. In 1990, Jonathan Frenzen and Harry Davis published a study entitled Purchasing Behavior in Embedded Markets that examined why Tupperware parties are so successful. All of their research led to this principle of liking. The researchers concluded that most people bought because they wanted the hostess to be happy, to help a friend, and to be liked. How embarrassing to go to a party like this and not buy anything. That fear of not being liked is what will drive most people to purchase at these parties, and it has little to do with wanting more Tupperware. Other surveys and studies have compared the trust that people have in receiving tips or advice from those they consider friends to the trust they have in complete strangers, or worse, people they don't like. A friend can give bad advice, and one may be more prone to follow it than good advice from a person one doesn't like. From a social engineering aspect, the concept of liking is a powerful tool. Not only do you have to be likable and win their trust, but you also have to genuinely be interested in people. This concept goes back to the discussion of pretexting in Chapter 4. When you pretext, you are not merely acting out an idea or a belief. You must become the person you are pretexting. That role is what your life is about. If you can do that, then the step of liking can become easier. Your pretext will be truly interested in helping, liking, or assisting that person. One last aspect of liking that is important for you as a social engineer is physical attractiveness. Humans tend to automatically like those who we find attractive. As vain as that sounds, it is the truth. Some serious psychological principles back up this idea. What is beautiful is good. In 1972, Burscheid, Walster, and Dion performed a study entitled just that, What is Beautiful is Good, which unleashed some very profound findings. Participants were asked to rate photos of three individuals ranging from low, medium, and high attractiveness. Based on the photos alone, they were to rate people for personality traits, overall happiness, and career success. They then compiled the ratings and averaged them and found that people who were deemed attractive were more socially desirable, had better occupations, were happier, and more successful. The study proved that people tend to link beauty with other successful qualities, and it alters their opinion and ability to trust someone. This study is an example of a phenomenon called the halo effect, where one particular trait influences or extends to other qualities of the person. It has been proven to bias a person's decision with a tendency to focus on the good traits of the other person. In other words, if someone views you as beautiful, then that good trait extends to other judgments that person makes about you. This halo effect is often used in marketing. Beautiful people are given products to drink, eat, and wear, and other people will automatically assume these things are good, possibly thinking, well, it must be good if this beautiful person is using it. Recently, I saw an ad on television that really hit this point home. The ad makes fun of marketing efforts, but does it very intelligently. An attractive young female comes on the screen wearing beautiful clothing and says, "Hi, I am a believably attractive 18 to 24-year-old female." Using an attractive female who is not overly attractive but believably real, someone we normal people can look up to is marketing genius. We can't really tell her age, but her beauty can place her somewhere between the ages of 18 and 24. You can relate to me because I am racially ambiguous. Again, this is another marketing genius tip. She is not black, white, or Native American. We can't tell. She may be a mix, which may be attractive to many races and is non-offensive to most. I am in this commercial because market research shows girls like you love girls like me. Her beauty and self-assuredness makes us like her. She is well-dressed, well-spoken, and we want to know her. The camera then pans to different shots of her doing things like kickboxing, cheerleading, and playing with flowers. By showing viewers she can do all of these things while being as beautiful as she is, we perceive her as strong and powerful, and all the things she's doing as good. Now, I'm going to tell you to buy something. She then goes on to sell tampons. This commercial is genius because the advertiser actually outlines, uses, and educates the consumer on the methods used to make you want to buy. But despite all that, within this commercial lies this principle of liking and the halo effect. Knowing all this about the importance of liking, what can you do? I have a hard enough time becoming an attractive male, let alone an attractive female. Because endless runs to my local plastic surgeon are out, is there anything a social engineer can do to capitalize on this principle? Know your target. Know what is and isn't acceptable to him or her. How does he dress, and what does he consider bad and good? Too much jewelry, makeup, or other aspect of dress can turn off a target. Suppose you are auditing a doctor's office and your pretext is a drug sales rep. You know that most reps wear suits, have perfect hair, and look, smell, and act confident. a trait of many attractive people. So walking in with spiked hair and facial piercings would draw more attention to yourself than your goal. You must know your target so you can successfully look the way your target would expect. Wear clothing, hairstyles, jewelry, and makeup that will not shock, surprise, or disgust the target.